Welcome to the Above Politics Show.
Like it or not, we live in times of danger and uncertainty.
Dedicated to intelligent discussion and debate of serious political issues in the U.S. and around the globe.
Absolutely unrealistic.
Borrowing money from China to finance the war in Iraq.
From AbovePolitics.com, this is the Above Politics Show.
The guest on this week's show is H.L. Quist, who has been involved in financial services for 35 years and a real estate developer for 10, which uniquely qualifies him to write his book, The Aftermath of Greed: Get Ready for the Coming Inflationary Boom. He began his writing career in 1993 when he published Trends, a nationally distributed economic newsletter. He has authored three other books and is a dynamic and motivational speaker. H.L., better known as Buster, was a two-time NCAA All-American in track and field and a member of four U.S. track teams. And I'm on the line with H.L. Quist, who is the author of The Aftermath of Greed: Get Ready for the Coming Inflationary Boom. Good morning.
Good morning, Martin. How are you?
Very well, thank you. And I know we've got you up at a fairly indecent hour for you, so I certainly do appreciate that one. And one of the things I sort of reading through some information on the book, it sort of talks about, and one of the things I'm very interested in is our leaders didn't seem to see this financial crisis coming, yet some of the businesses that I work for and with seem to have seen this crisis coming and started doing things maybe even 12 to 18 months ago. So why do you think that our politicians and our world leaders really didn't see this coming?
Well, I think one of the focal persons, of course, is Alan Greenspan, the former chairman of the Federal Reserve. You know, he maintained in many interviews that he didn't see this coming, you know, took that position. And it's amazing to, because, you know, he was on board from, you know, 1987 to 2007, in that period. And, you know, he is the focal person because as head of the Federal Reserve, he really is the person that conducts monetary policy for the country. And it's amazing to, you know, he was regaled as the maestro, you know, of the symphony. And he had all these accolades right up until this whole situation came down here in 2007, 2008. And I was just reading, doing some material because I'm writing a sequel, and how he was called to testify at Congress here over the last couple of months, and how the whole tenor has changed. He was questioned, and he'd start into these digressing into this long, oblique conversation like he's famous for, and the congressman would cut him off, and they'd say, "No, we don't, you know, we don't want this old dialogue, the same old thing. We want to get to the heart of the matter." So he's been totally discredited, and finally, the public and even the financial people have been forced to admit. That he was the key person that brought us to this point. He's the person that's responsible for this, the aftermath of greed. And you know, he talks in his book, The Age of Turbulence. He talks about his independence and how the Federal Reserve is above politics, and not to play on words there, but he is a product of and serves not the people, certainly not the middle class, but it's this I call them the masters of the universe, and I use another term, the masters, the merchants of debt, in my book, and that's all changed now. I mean, the power. I mean, that's one reason why Obama was elected, is the resentment. Terrible amount of resentment by the American people against leadership that made these decisions and got us to this point where we're basically the country is just economically is in this nosedive, and we've seen a tremendous shift now with the Obama election and so forth. Is that I was just doing some research, and there was an article in the Wall Street Journal back in a couple months ago that said the day that Wall Street died was the day that Lehman Brothers filed for bankruptcy, and that marked the end of investment banks in the United States. There are now commercial banks, the only four that are remaining, and the shift in power has gone from Wall Street to Washington, and I think that's a significant point in our history and in our economy and in our future. And
is there an event, I mean, I know you sort of talk that Alan Greenspan, you see, sort of should have seen this coming. And I'm sort of curious to see what you think as the reasons for this one. And certainly I think a lot of people think it was to do with these financial instruments that had these subprime loans built up into them, and then people were obviously trying to sell. Yeah. So do you see that as being the fundamental cause, that basically people were selling debt?
Well, I think that I call Greenspan and that whole clique, Secretary of Treasury and so forth, as their hired gun. The Greenspan professes that he's independent. He's not independent. He is complying to the wishes of the bankers and Wall Street and the big money people. And of course, he was doing their bidding. I think that one thing is really critical that supports this thesis that I have is that, you know, back in 1998, long-term capital management failed because of the use. Remember the two guys, Morton and Scholes, that got the Nobel Peace Prize in economics for developing this model, black box model, that permitted, you know, through the use of derivatives, extraordinary gains and no risk. And it didn't take a year after they raised all these billions and billions of equity capital and borrowed billions more, leveraged it up 10 to 20 to 1 that failed, this was the derivatives and the use of derivatives. Well, instead of, you know, Congress wanted to investigate and regulate the use of dividend, and the number one front man to go to Congress and insist that the government not regulate the use of derivatives was Alan Greenspan. Also Hank Paulson, who was then with Goldman Sachs, and others. Here we had this. This was the a warning, if you will, that these highly leveraged bet speculation and was going to create problems. And 10 years later, of course, it became a massive problem. I mean, they're talking about over $500 trillion in the nominal value of derivatives had, and most of that had come in that 10-year period from 1990 to the current day. We had the warnings. Enron was another warning for the use of derivatives, and Congress wasn't able to regulate them because there was so much power on Wall Street and so much power at the Federal Reserve, and that prevented the regulation of these vehicles and these highly leveraged bets. So when I wrote the book, my wife was a PhD. She just said, you know, you blame Alan Greenspan for that. I think that you're way out of line. And she and I were watching a documentary on the Ascent of Money the other day that was on PBS, and it was a 2-hour show, and highly recommend it for our listeners. And it traced all of this, what's happened since, you know, well, since time immemorial, but I mean the most important thing was what's happened here in the last 10 years or so. And she sat back and she looked at me and she said, well, I agree with you. I understand now why you affix the blame and directly to Greenspan and others for creating this massive amount of leverage and taking us to this point. And, you know, the systemic risk in the banking system was because of all of this. Wanted to create this tremendous, Paulson is the number one guy when he was at Goldman Sachs that got the SEC, Securities Exchange Commission, to allow the leverage to go from 10 to 20 to 1, 30 to 40 to 1, and allowed these investment banks to leverage up their capital that much. So this was, that's where they had the power. They were able to carry that off and get the politicians to agree to it and prevent the regulation. And that's carried through to Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and all of that, too. So that's why I say that I think the most significant thing today is that we've seen this transfer of power now to Wall Street, Washington, and I don't know which is the scariest.
And just as I'm not sure all our listeners will sort of understand a couple of the terms you've used, so if you've used the term derivative, is there a simple explanation for that?
Oh, very good. I'm glad you brought that up, Martin. I, in my second book, I spend some time to educate the reader. A derivative, asset that derived from another asset. And for instance, a stock option, or you purchase an option to purchase, that allows you to purchase 100 shares of stock in the future, say 60 or 90 days, that instrument, that piece of paper, that contract is a derivative because it's derived from the stock itself. And, so you've got call options and put options, so forth. Those are simple examples of derivative. Or, on the other hand, you might have a farmer, for example, who wants to hedge his crop, and he'll sell his crop forward, say cotton, or he'll sell wheat or whatever forward. That's been in use for virtually 100 years. And to lock in the price of the cotton at the time that he harvests the crop. And so if the market goes south and he's at least locked in a price that he can make a profit and retires indebtedness and so forth. So what Wall Street did is they took this basic concept of the derivative and they magnified it and they leveraged it up 30, 40 times. And that's what's created when you get back to the real estate market in the United States, all of the bundling of these subprime mortgages were packaged together, and then Wall Street sold them all over the world, as you know, and then in the UK, and they were leveraging up these packages. They're making enormous profits on packaging and marketing them, and they also leveraged them up. And so they had double or triple whammy when the market started going south in these packages of these with collateralized debt obligations and credit swaps, default swaps, so forth. They were so highly leveraged that when the market started to crack, well, it just the losses just pyramided and rapidly at AIG, the American International Group, and so forth. So they were making so much money, which I point out in my book, and it's just amazing. I saw this coming. I'm fortunate that I have forecast the last 5 boom and bust cycles in the United States since 1992, 93, and I wrote and I had seminars, and in the summer of 2005, I said this real estate and leveraged speculative morass that Wall Street has created is going to, there's going to be a crash, and I recommended that people sell their real estate at the top of this market and take their $500,000 of tax-free money from the sale of their house and securitize their future and put it away, because I said this market is going to crash. It's going to be a unbelievable, not only a correction, but a deflation of assets. And amazingly, people thought, oh my gosh, well this, you know, I'm not going to sell my house now. I think the market's going higher. So, you know, that's part of the whole greed phenomena. You know, there was greed not only on Wall Street trying to earn unbelievable amounts of return on investment, but it was also greed in the public. You know, the easiest sale to make to someone, Martin, is appealing to their greed, and that's what these mortgage brokers and these con artists did, is that, you know, that's how they were able to sign these people up on these no doc loans, so forth, no documents, and is put money in their pocket, and no consideration for whether or not they could pay that back. A lot of people just fraudulently took the money and ran, and it was just abuse all the way through the system.
And do you think that certainly in the US, the UK, certainly in the Netherlands, certainly in Germany and other parts of the world, were our governments right to basically listen to the financial institutions and the banks and give them trillions of pounds and dollars and euros to recapitalize themselves? Or should, if we take the whole concept of a free market, should we have just let these financial institutions fail because they clearly weren't up to the mark of being able to cope with the global economy?
Well, their actions and their strategy actually put everybody at risk. You know, they and we're the ones that pay the price. We're the ones that's vulnerable. And you know, when Paulson came and Bernanke came to Congress and they said, look, you've got to do this TARP program, otherwise we're looking at a global depression, they have you over the barrel. you know, they're threatening that business is going to come to a standstill, and that the markets would freeze up. I believe that they're right. I mean, certainly, you could take in the position, well, let's just let nature take its course. But I know enough about the financial markets that I knew that the market, we were at such a vulnerable point that we would, the markets would have frozen. We could have had a severe crisis all over the world, and the result, of course, would be massive deflation, and we're looking in the face of a depression like the 30s. But who knows? And you know, that's still a risk, that this inserting this trillions of dollars into the U.S. Financial system is not a sure fix. And we know that they're going to continue throwing whatever amount of money it takes, but there is no guarantee that this is going to work. We may end up in the same place with deflation and a depression, and all of this would have been done for naught, and we have all the debt to pay. So, but I'm taking, in my book, I take the opposite position. I take the position that we're going to get through the deflation, we're going to get through the crisis. The result of it is going to be credible, first monetary inflation and then price inflation, and the real threat is hyperinflation 2 or 3 years down the road.
I'm just trying to understand, you were sort of saying that if the US government, among others, and global governments had not bailed out the banks, people have sort of said we would have had a crisis, things would have frozen. I'm trying to understand what physically would have happened. Would suddenly there be no, you know, I wouldn't have been paid, there would be no money, there would be no crops, there would be no movements of stuff, there would be nothing to for sale in the shops. People have blithely sort of said the markets would have frozen, but, you know, hundreds of years ago, we didn't have these markets and we were still around, so I really can't see these banks fail. Okay, thousands of people out of jobs, maybe millions, billions of euros, pounds, and dollars are sort of at risk somewhere. But what physically happens?
Well, I think all commerce comes to a stop. You know, one of the eras. You know, I go back and I trace the 10 boom and bust cycle ever since 1974. You know, that 73-74 period when we had the oil shock, when the oil embargo. I remember that so well because it was such a shock that basically all commerce came to a screeching halt. The banks didn't stop making any loans, and of course we weren't leveraged. The banking system wasn't leveraged, and Wall Street wasn't leveraged at that time. But all commerce came to a stop, and the price of gasoline went from 25 cents a gallon to $1.25 overnight. But you couldn't get a loan for a car, you couldn't, real estate transactions, here in Phoenix, real estate development came to a stop, and projects were taken back. Obviously, we recovered from that, and we recovered rapidly from that. You know, Carter became president, and within 18 months, the stock market, which was down 50%, regained its former level, and then, of course, they threw so much money at the problem that we had incredible inflation in the United States from 1976 to 1980. And I see somewhat a repeat of that, Martin, that period. And I use that period as an example because we were coming from a where the economy had come to a screeching halt in 73 and 74, Nixon's resignation, the whole Watergate thing and so forth. And then from the bottom of that market with a new president, which of course I equate to Obama coming in, is that they threw all this money and these programs at the situation, at the deflation, and it resulted in double-digit inflation in 78, 79, and 80. And then we had real estate going up 200-300% here in the Phoenix metro area. And then 1980, the bus came. But I kind of see a repeat of similar situation as that period because the politics are the same, and they're going to throw as much money at it to cure the problem. And the way I look at it is that the problem was unprecedented in American history. The solution that they've offered, with all of Congress passing all this legislation and the TARP program and the FHA bill and everything, and the remedy that Congress has created in the stimulus package is also unprecedented. So therefore, I conclude that the results that we're going to look at from the next 2 or 3 years are going to be unprecedented, which is going to be unprecedented inflation, not only in the United States, but all over the world. So that's kind of sum and substance is kind of where I'm coming from.
And just before I sort of go on to talk about the inflationary bit, certainly in the UK we have nationalised some banks so that, you know, rather than being commercial concerns, we've got Northern Rock. In reality, Royal Bank of Scotland is all but nationalised, as the government owns 70% of it. The Lloyds TSB Group is, I think, a fairly significant stake. If you were talking that if the governments hadn't done anything, commerce would have come to a standstill, why didn't the government just take all this money and divide it among the taxpayers and say, here you are, why don't we give every taxpayer $10,000, which they will then go out and spend, which would stimulate the economy? Because I still don't see that the fact that, say, my government in the United Kingdom have, you know, spent £1 trillion, the US government is spending trillions of dollars, I don't see anything happening. I don't see businesses suddenly saying, yeah, everything's rosy, so why not just give the money to the taxpayer and say to every taxpayer in the US, here's $10,000, go out and spend it.
Well, you know, I think you're absolutely correct, and my point that I made is that the reason why they're pouring all these trillions of dollars into this black hole is because they're saving the banks. And of course, you know, the guys that were demanding that the banks be bailed out, Paulson and Greenspan and Bernanke, that whole group, you know, they're just taking care of their brothers. That's the clique. That's the banking clique in America. My recommendation and my thought was that it's this enormous amount of leverage with this, with the derivatives. And my suggestion was, why didn't they just cancel all of these derivative contracts on the credit default swaps and the CDOs and so forth? Because that's where the black hole was. Nobody knew what the amount was that they had to put in this to keep AIG afloat and all of these institutions. You know, these contracts that these counterparties had with and in ensuring these performance of these CDOs and so forth, why didn't they just cancel all these contracts and, as you said, put $10,000 into everybody, into every taxpayer's hand or every person in the United States and or in other countries, and give them the cash during this period during the shock of the of this catastrophic event, and so that people had money and save this trillions and trillions of dollars that they're pouring into this massive black hole. And it was because of the leverage. I mean, it was just the CDOs and Wall Street had leveraged this up that and they're just bailing out. I just doing all the research on Lehman. Why was Lehman Brothers, why did the government not come to the aid of Lehman Brothers when they bailed out Bear Stearns and Merrill Lynch and all the other investment banks? That's an interesting scenario to look into. But, you know, there's no question that the bankers were saving the banks. That's the bottom line. And Bernanke and Paulson and so forth, they were saving the investment banks. Whatever reason they didn't want to save Lehman, probably because the pit was and the hole was so big that they didn't think that they could save it, but it's an amazing phenomenon. And, you know, history, 50 years and 100 years from now, the historians will write about this period that it was enormous greed that brought about the whole aftermath that that we're dealing with, and they're going to, and we're seeing a tremendous transfer in power. And I think the risk, Martin, is that it's so easy now to demonize capitalism. In other words, it was capitalism that brought us to this point, and that the entrepreneurs and the these financial engineers brought us to this point. And you see, one reason why Obama is president, and is we're going to go to basically a socialistic type government now, is because capitalism was the bad boy, and all of these capitalists got us to this point, and now the power is in the hands of government, and we're going to do things differently. So that is another risk that, that the American people are now faced with, is a change in the way our government does business.
One of the things I know you spoke about was the coming inflationary boom, but I don't see that today. I see the price of gas has come down. I see the prices of food coming down. I see the prices of many things coming down, bearing in mind that, you know, petrol in the United Kingdom got to £1.15 a litre. In the States, I think, got to around about $4 a gallon.
Yes.
I see this as, you know, there's some kind of balancing out here of high prices. Now we're getting low prices. Why do you think we're going to see, you know, coming inflationary pressure? And if you take this coming inflationary pressure, where do you see the price of things like gas and, you know, normal commodities being maybe in 12 to 18 months' time?
Good question. You know, that's where I differ from most economists, and their projections is going to be a long-term recovery to get back to a normal economy, whatever that means, where gross domestic product would be in the 2.5 to 4% range. But here's where I differ, is that inflation is a monetary phenomenon. Inflation is created by excess amount of money in the financial system, and of course that's what we're experiencing now. Now the goal of the bankers, the Federal Reserve, the Treasury Department, and the politics is to inflate assets. We've got, perhaps in America, we've got 10 million homes that there's more debt on those homes than there is value. In other words, they're underwater. Now the whole, and they don't say this, but this is the whole approach, this is the whole strategy, is to inflate assets. In other words, get real estate prices and values to increase. Now, you can have asset inflation without price inflation. In other words, the prices of goods and services, of gasoline and so forth. That'll be a lagging, that will come later. But what we're going to see, in my opinion, is we're going to see asset inflation. There is somewhere around $9 or $10 trillion that people have invested now in U.S. Treasuries and money market fund, that they put that money there because they were fearful that, you know, everything could come to a standstill, that we could have a massive deflation or depression, and they bought U.S. Treasuries and bonds. And people are going to, here in by spring and by summer, money is going to start flowing out of these treasuries into higher risk assets, the stock market, real estate, and so forth, because people are going to get tired of 50 basis points return on their money market at best. And to the people that, what I call the smart money, people that are really knowledgeable, they got into bonds a year and a half ago. They are sitting on gains, as these interest rates have plummeted, they're sitting on gains of 20, 30, and 40% in the longer term bonds, the 10 years and the 20 years and so forth. The smart money, the hedge funds and the institutional money, they're going to pull that money out and put it into higher risk and higher return, looking for higher return, and they're going to lock in those profits that they have made. So there is a tremendous amount of money sitting on the sideline that, as soon as the indication is that the market is stabilizing, even though the numbers are terrible, the stock market market is going to anticipate 6 to 9 months in advance a turnaround, and that money is going to, I expect that we'll see a dramatic bear market rally in the U.S. stock market here in the next, certainly in the next 90 days, maybe up 10, 15, 20, 25%. And the smart money is going to want to participate in that. So they're going to lock in their profits in the bonds, and they're going to turn around and they're going to make that gain in the stock market. Of course, that's a bear market rally and they'll have another correction and so forth. But that will mark the end of the bear market in stocks. And the irony in all of this is that we will have traditional price inflation where you have a scarcity of goods. I made the comment in the speech that I gave this past week that by Christmas time, of 09, this Christmas, we can have shortages in the United States in soft good, in toys, and other, you know, traditional Christmas type products, because so many retailers have gone out of business, so many, the inventories have been slashed to the bare bone, and we're not importing, we're certainly not importing toys from China to a large degree, and we could find ourselves in a classic traditional inflationary cycle with there's too much money chasing too few products. But the first thing is asset inflation. You can have assets inflate even though unemployment may reach 10%, even though all the other indicators are flat, even though the GDP is negative. You can have assets inflate, and basically that's what Greenspan did in the fall of 2002, is to get real estate values to appreciate so people would refinance, take the money out, and then, of course, spend it. And then later, consumer prices started to rise when people were using their homes as ATM. And of course, my whole approach and educating people is that there's a lot of money to be made in the early stages of this inflationary cycle. And obviously the stock market being one, as we just talked about, and real estate. I mean, the real estate values now here in the Phoenix metropolitan area, in most areas of the country. This market in Phoenix will rebound as fast or faster than any area in the country. And we already see large investment capital and syndicators and vulture funds and people coming in and buying all these foreclosed homes at auction and so forth. So that has already started. And I think that by mid-year this year, we'll see a significant change in the psychology and the market, people taking advantage of these prices and looking for opportunities. And this money was, we know the money is sitting there in the bonds and the money markets, and people are going to be willing to take risk. And but the big thing is, Martin, that is going to change everything, and it's already changing now, is the psychology. The sentiment and the psychology, and this is the first time in America that we've had this type of fervor. There's millions and millions of people in America that look to Obama as a messiah, a person who's going to take care of the lower class, the middle class, and that's the program. And that changes the outlook, that changes the sentiment. That's something that economists cannot quantify. They can't put a number on it. But I think it's one of the biggest drivers towards a recapture of the and a rebound in the economy, and that's something that people don't estimate. That's something I think that is powerful, and I think this whole inflationary trend is going to surprise people on the upside. You know, I tell my audiences, I ask them, what does inflation have in common with Paris Hilton? And they all have blank faces and looks on their faces, of course. And I say, well, they both have bad reputation. And, you know, inflation in this economy at this point in time is good. And that could last, you know, we could have this the good part of the trend last for a year, 2 years, and then it's up to this new administration on how they deal with the increases in prices and values and so forth to prevent hyperinflation, because I think that's the threat, you know, 2 or 3 years from now.
And when you mean hyperinflation, are we talking like Zimbabwe? Are we talking of tens of thousands of percent, hundreds of percent?
Well, we've got a lot of history of hyperinflation, and hyperinflation is defined by the economists as when prices of goods and services exceed 25% per year. So in the 77, 78, 79, 80, we had 13% increase in the consumer price index here in the United States. And but all we have to do, the model really, is to look at Latin America. Latin America during the mid-80s had 5 and 10,000% inflation in Brazil, Argentina, and these other countries because they created so much paper money to cure their economy and the downturn in the economy. The government's just printed money, and of course that's what we're doing here in the United States now, is printing inordinate amount of money. We've never been this way. It faced this except during World War II in 1942, 1943, where we created a tremendous amount of money out of thin air. But the model for hyperinflation, of course, the time-wise, Argentina would be 1999, 2000, when they had real severe inflation, and of course they had what is referred to as a crack-up boom in 2000. But that is the risk, is that we in America have abandoned all monetary principle that has guided this country for hundreds of years, and this is unprecedented what we're doing, and I think the results are going to be unprecedented.
What do you think President Obama can actually do? And I'm really interested in, you were sort of saying that you sort of see the balance of power has moved from Wall Street to Washington, that, you know, you've mentioned a word that many Americans will probably run screaming from, the socialist word. What can President Obama do? Can he, you know, you've spoken about this very warm feeling that he has, and that people feel he's going to look after the lower classes. But what in reality can he actually do to solve the problem? You know, is he going to turn around and say, guess what, banks, you're not getting any more money, I'm going to nationalize them all, or I'm going to say, I'm going to put such draconian measures in place that I'm basically going to, you know, almost have a true socialist state where the government decides the economic policy?
Well, basically, we've nationalized the banks now. You know, when the TARP money went into the banks, the Federal Reserve and the Treasury Department now basically control the banks. So we've already, and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, of course, the largest mortgage providers in the United States, they're nationalized. So we've already made that move. I think, Martin, I think this is kind of a curious position. As you can see, I'm a visionary person, and I'm looking at, you know, macroeconomic factors and political factors and so forth, but that's why I've been so successful in my forecast. But what I see happening is that Obama is going to have, the difficulty he's going to have is with the control he has in the House of Representatives and the Senate. He, by the second year, he could be in the same position that Jimmy Carter was. They had all these programs, and once the economy got going, then of course the far left wanted more programs and more money for all of these programs that they're going to advance. I mean, we're going to see legislation in this country that we're not even going to believe. And the problem Obama's going to have looking towards the election in 4 years is, how does he curtail the far left so that he doesn't, number one, create a hyperinflationary situation monetarily, or two, get such an adverse reaction politically, and the right, of course, is going to come down hard on us. So he's going to want to be mainstream, he's going to want to, you know, drift to the middle, and I think the real battle ahead is Obama's going to have with his own party, just as Jimmy Carter did. Jimmy Carter ran into conflict with Tip O'Neill and the Democrats Democratic-controlled Congress and Senate, and that's one reason what's led to his downfall, plus the situation in Iran. But I think that obviously they're going to throw all the money and all these programs to cure the deflation and the threat of a depression today, and then 2 years from now, he's going to be drifting back to the middle and trying to curtail all of these programs that his Democratic-controlled Congress is going to be putting forth.
So presumably what's going to happen is that the generations to come are going to be saddled with trillions of dollars of debt.
That is the huge fear, and I think that whether it's 4 years, 5 years, 6 years from now, or whatever, is this trillions and trillions of debt, credit cards, automobile loans, whatever, is never going to be repaid. That is the ultimate crack-up boom. I'm encouraging people to educate themselves and understand what's going on economically. There's opportunities to profit here in the next year, 2 years, 3 years maybe. But if this situation gets out of hand, then I'm an Austrian economist, and I believe that von Mises was correct when he portrayed, I think we've created the perfect storm in this country and globally for a crack-up boom. And that could occur in 3 years, 4 years, 5 years from now. But at that point in time, all this debt, we can't service the debt. We can't service the credit card debt. We can't service the automobile and student loans and everything. And at some point in time, there's going to be a massive contraction in the write-down and write-off of virtually all this debt. That's what the Depression did. That's what the 1930s did, is that there wasn't any debt. My parents didn't have any debt on anything. They couldn't borrow any money, and didn't have the income to borrow any money, and all of the, I don't know how much debt they had coming into 1930, 1931, 32, but whatever debt they had was just vanished.
So in reality, could we say what happened in Iceland is what you're describing? Because it seems in Iceland they've just sort of, you know, almost put the country up and said that we can't afford anything, we're bankrupt, you basically have to write everything off.
Iceland is the microcosm of the world, and I think that that's an illustration of what can happen when it gets out of hand and you have basically a crack-up boom. And of course, the crack-up boom is the classic case. Of course, is Weimar Germany in 1923. And Zimbabwe today, of course, it's more than a crack-up boom. I mean, it's just, you know, what is it, millions, hundreds of millions of percent inflation. I mean, it's incomprehensible what's happened in a country that, you know, the average annual income is about, you know, $400 or $500, and unemployment is 70%. So that's an example that you can have uncontrolled hyperinflation when unemployment is at such a high level. So, you know, people say these things can't happen. They don't know their history, and they don't know what can happen when you get in an unprecedented situation like we're in today.
Okay, and first of all, I just want to thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us. So where can people know, you know, listen or and hear more about what you've got to say? Where can they get your books? And if you've got any public appearances coming up?
Yes, the best, you can Google H.L. Quist. My last name is Quist. And I have a blog site which has got a wealth of information for our listeners. It's free. I've got videos. I've updated my book through my blog. It's a rather long address, so if people got a pen or pencil in hand, the aftermath of greed-updates, updates dot blogspot, blogspot, one word, .com.
And if you
so
didn't,
that, and you can get, and people can get that just if they Google H.L. Quist, Google will refer them to either my website, which is through my publisher, or through my blog, and they can have access to my blog. But there's just a tremendous amount of information there that I've written over the months, particularly over the last 6 months.
Well, we'll make sure that link to your blog site goes up on the show notes for this one. So if you didn't get that address, don't panic, listeners. Homer and I will make sure that it goes out. Well, I want to thank you very much for coming on the show.
Well, Martin, it's been enjoyable. I'm glad that I was alert enough at 6 o'clock in the morning here and articulate enough. I think I'm awake now. I hope it's made sense to our listeners. And this is just a remarkable time in world history, and this is the time for our audience to be educate themselves, because don't sit idly by and just take the body blows. I mean, there's something that you can do about it to protect yourself, and there are incredible opportunities ahead as far as investments are concerned.
I'm sure that I will. Thank you very much, and appreciate the time.
Thank you, Martin. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Above Politics Show. If you have a comment, suggestion, or an opposing view, please deliver it at abovepolitics.com. The views expressed on the Above Politics Show do not necessarily reflect the staff and management of the Above Network LLC or any of its affiliates. Thanks for listening, and please continue to deny apathy.